But nobody in the international media talks about the tens of thousands of Israeli families who are effectively refugees inside their own country, the displaced people from the north, the displaced families from the south.
So this is personal. As a British citizen, you feel almost personal about it.
I feel very personal about it, not just as a British citizen, but as a human being. Hamas is a fire. Hamas needs to be put out. It needs to be destroyed. There's no point in destroying three quarters of Hamas. The fire will start again. Next month, next year, 3 years down the line.
Welcome to a very special episode of History for the Curious. Our podcast, which we started just over 2 years ago, myself with Rabbi Aubrey Hirsch, focuses on the last 3,000 years of Jewish history. Since the war started in Israel, we've veered off our conventional history episodes due to this whole saga being on everyone's minds all the time. Today, we were honored to interview a very well-known and prominent voice advocating for Israel, Douglas Murray. Douglas Murray is an author and journalist based in London, and his book, The Strange Death of Europe, was a bestseller. Douglas is the associate editor of The Spectator, and he has written for many newspapers, including The Times, The Sunday Times, The Wall Street Journal, and others. A prolific debater, Douglas has appeared on many platforms, such as the British and American parliaments, and even at the White House. Since the tragic massacre on October the 7th, Douglas has emerged as a resolute advocate for Israel, fearlessly championing its rights to exist and defend itself against terror. We often feel alone and vilified in global media, and hearing Douglas's voice on the most prominent platforms in the world gives us at least some comfort that there's someone out there who's willing to potentially risk everything in order to defend the truth. But before we start, a few words from our sponsor. A big welcome to Avi Lisser of Hermeless Fame to our studio. We want to extend a huge thank you to yourself and the entire team at Hermeless for sponsoring this very special podcast. What are the things that potentially the public or our listeners would not know?
So I would say there's 2 points. The first point is we are currently supplying fresh kosher food to the most amazing locations. So if somebody's going for a spa day and they want a hot lunch, if somebody's going for a drink in a rooftop bar, they will order canapés. Somebody will be going for an afternoon tea, a three-course dinner at any of the hotel, any level. They will be having kosher food. And I would say the coolest one is where we have a guy who's going with a non-kosher eating colleague to a non-kosher restaurant. They can have dinner or lunch, whatever it may be, together. We would then be able to menu match so that the gentleman will be eating with his non-kosher colleague the same menu. Probably the only difference would be that our portions would be larger. Either you go onto the website or just email sales@modest.com. The team are trained. They'll take you through. They'll advise which location. Fully au fait with the entire process. Point number two would be people will say, last week I traveled and something's added onto the tray. Something's come off the tray. Most of the time, our menus, which are being chosen by the airline, is based on the non-kosher, and we're fully bound by them.
Got it. Go check out homolis.com if you want to taste some good kosher food. Avi, thanks so much for coming in, and thank you for your sponsorship.
It's an absolute pleasure, and bon appetit.
It's a pleasure to meet you last night at the ICA, and thank you for your remarkable words last night, and thank you for the amazing work, and thank you for hosting us today.
Well, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be with you both.
Thank you. So can I just start by asking, I guess, the question that's foremost on everyone's minds, at least in the Jewish community. You appeared on TV and on speaking engagements around the world, and probably the most visible or loudest pro-Israel voice globally. Why? Why have you devoted everything to fight this cause? And why indeed are you so clearly passionate about it?
In a way, I'd turn around the question and say, why wouldn't you be? Who wouldn't be? I've covered a lot of wars in my life, and I've been in Israel during many wars as well as during peacetime since the 2006 Lebanon-Hezbollah war. And I certainly noticed then, 18 years ago now, the extraordinary disconnect between what I was seeing on the ground and what I was reading in the international media. And it's very striking to me. I was in Ukraine last year, the year before, and was with Ukrainian forces as they were pushing back against the Russian advances. And I saw only international support for the Ukrainian army in their war against the aggressors. And I saw nobody saying, the Ukrainians should be more careful or shouldn't be allowed to win, or that really what we must do is to get to a ceasefire situation. You know, only in conflicts involving Israel does that happen. And when you say, why am I so motivated by it? Largely, I would say it's because I have an intense dislike of lies, and I'm motivated by searching for the truth. And if you are interested in searching for the truth, when it comes to conflicts involving the only Jewish state in the world and any of its enemies, you just see a sea of lies pushed out. And I believe that they're pushed out largely through intense animus, including bigotry towards the Jewish state. And I also think, as a second order, I'm motivated because I think that the people who are doing this and who always do this to the state of Israel when it's in a war are the same people who do the same thing to my country of Britain and to America and to all the Western democracies. There's an absolutely clear line of predictability. If somebody gives you their views on Palestinian, Hamas, Israel conflicts, you can guess where they are about Britain and about America and everything else. You can pretty much guess their views on capitalism, on Cuba these days. You can guess their attitudes on everything. This is a la carte bigotry.
So this is personal. As a British citizen, you feel almost personal about it.
I feel very personal about it, and not just as a British citizen, but as a human being.
How would you therefore understand the vast majority of your journalistic colleagues that don't seem to be able to differentiate right and wrong as clearly as you have? I mean, when you speak, obviously I've got loads of family in Israel, so I'm somewhat biased, but you as a more objective journalist who is so clearly differentiating between right and wrong. And yet, as you said right at the beginning, the question should be flipped. Why are you so in a spotlight and you're not joined by the masses?
Well, I'd like to be. I am in some ways. I think the silent majority, as it's often described, I always wish was less silent, understands a lot of the things that I understand. It's a peculiarity of our era that it's unusual to see things as I see it among the commentariat, among the journalistic and political classes. I think it's a lot of things. If I was able to put it down to two groups, I would say that there's a group of journalists and others who find the Israel-Palestinian issue an enormously comfortable conflict to commentate on. Not to make it too simplistic, but, you know, Syria is a pretty difficult conflict to cover, which is why pretty much since the murder of Marie Colvin, very few Western journalists were in Syria. Some of those who were fell into the hands of ISIS. The Ukraine war isn't much fun to cover. Most wars in the Middle East aren't. Very few journalists have made it to Yemen in the last few years, when about 400,000 people have been killed by Muslims. Muslims by other Muslims. But the Israel-Palestinian issue, you know, you can cover it. You can stay at the American Colony Hotel in East Jerusalem. You can have cocktails by the pool. And you can put on a flak jacket, stand outside, and report back to London or Washington from occupied East Jerusalem, you know. It's quite a comfortable conflict in that way, and I don't say that lightly. Journalists overdo their bravery. So that's one thing. The second thing is, I think, is the bigotry that exists. And I think a lot of people are entirely unaware of it. Entirely unaware of it. They obsess about this one country. And I just always want to ask them, why? Why? Where were you with the Uyghurs in China? Where were you when Assad was slaughtering many times the number of people who had been killed in every war involving Israel? Where were you on Yemen? Where were you on any of this? And the answer is, you were nowhere. So the onus is on them, in my view, to explain why this is, why this peculiarity, why this fetish.
Have you ever had occasion to speak or question some of these journalists who are involved in the Middle Eastern conflict and who are reporting in what you would really call a biased or a subjective fashion? Have you asked them, and what has been their response?
Yes, I mean, I've spoken to many of my colleagues across the media. And generally speaking, what it is that they go in and they know how to cover this conflict. The conflict always begins with Israel, not when Israel is attacked, but when it responds, as you know. I mean, I said on October 7th to a friend, I think they'll probably give us a day. the world. You know, they'll give us a day to say, oh, something terrible has happened. But sure enough, by the next day, by the Sunday, all of the world's media, you know, Israel's retaliation, what will Israel's disproportionate reaction be? How will Israel? That's what they're interested in.
They were defending themselves before they actually made a move itself.
Yes. I mean, people, as we know, there were protests in London and in New York, where I was on the 7th, and in Times Square the next day, they were protesting against Israel before Israel had done anything. All that had happened was that Israel had been attacked. But they're already onto it. They're already het up on this. I think they enjoy this line of story. I think they enjoy the line of, oh, what will Israel's terrifying response be? And there's lots of reasons for that, by the way. One of them, again, to go back to it, is a technical one. You know, I have a friend as a Palestinian journalist who years ago wrote something critical of Yasser Arafat and was made very clear that he was never to return to the West Bank again. That's the same with any reporter for Sky or BBC. If they were to expose the corruption, not just Hamas, the PLO, PA, they would find it quite hard to operate in areas they would like to operate on. I do, by contrast, notice that the Israeli media, like the British and American media, has no problem criticizing its own leaders. So yes, you can report on aspects of this conflict quite comfortably. There are other aspects on it you cannot report on quite comfortably. And this desire to sort of say, we will focus on the response, always leads to this just absolute skewing of the reporting of the direction of the war. I've just written a piece in my column in The Spectator this week saying, we've heard a lot about Palestinian refugees in Gaza, and perhaps rightly so. But nobody in the international media talks about the tens of thousands of Israeli families who are effectively refugees inside their own country, the displaced people from the north, the displaced families from the south. The world media doesn't seem to care about this. One reason why, of course, as you both know, but some people listening might not, is the Israeli government actually looks after the Israeli people who can't live in their houses because they're within rocket fire of Hezbollah or Hamas. The Hamas in Gaza noticeably does not seem to exercise the same duty of care to the people in Gaza, but people can draw their own conclusions from that.
I suppose that differentiates you massively from the other journalists who never bother to actually go to a place and see it with their own eyes.
No, they don't bother to speak to people.
Yes. Final point on that. There's been, Piers Morgan has been very vocal, and you've appeared on his show many times regarding the war. And there was the sort of tone that was at the beginning was very much post-massacre and Israel has the right to defend itself and respond. But I've noticed himself and many others in the field haven't remained consistent as Israel has responded. You know, there's more of a moral quandary, as he seems to put it. But I think even going on the political side, David Cameron's letter that you mentioned last night at the dinner was surprising. I mean, I heard a speech from David Cameron on the early days of the war, even a few weeks after, and he was almost like it was Bibi Netanyahu speaking. You know, we have to respond and we have to defend ourselves against terror. And then the letter yesterday just sort of sent a bit of a surprise.
David Cameron is weak. He was a very weak man. And I mean, I knew at the beginning that we would lose him within some weeks or months. I see everyone on the right side on this. I have very little sympathy with or interest in people who say you have a right to respond, and then once you start to respond, encourage you to not win. There's no point in starting a conflict. And I mean, of course, it was Hamas who started this conflict, but there's no point in responding in a conflict and not winning. There's absolutely no point in it. It is, as Benny Gantz said a couple of days ago, like putting out three quarters of a fire. You don't put out three quarters of a fire, you put out the whole fire. Hamas is a fire. Hamas needs to be put out. It needs to be destroyed. There's no point in destroying three quarters of Hamas. The fire will start again. Next month, next year, 3 years down the line. So I have no sympathy for people like David Cameron, who at the beginning say, yes, you should respond. And then when you do respond, try to stop you from winning.
Like I said at the beginning, that you've been a great source of comfort to the Jewish people. Do you feel you've gotten anywhere with your advocacy in the bigger picture? Has it had an impact on politics, on people's mindset, on the general public?
I have no idea. It's not my place to judge. I'm not an advocate. I'm a writer. I say things as I see them. And if what I regard as the truth gets through to people, then I'm extremely happy. That I wouldn't write and speak if I thought that I was speaking to no purpose. I believe that many people retain the capability, not everyone, but many people retain the capability to notice one lie amid a sea of untruths. And again, I wouldn't be a writer. I wouldn't do what I do if I thought it was hopeless. I wouldn't say what I regard as the truth if I thought that it was simply going to be drowned out by lies. And, you know, many of the lies are quite straightforward. I mean, you mentioned Piers earlier, but he has this man, Mustafa Barghouti, on his show quite often, a man who's incapable of telling the truth, and also seems to have developed a sort of circular breathing technique so that he's uninterruptible. He just lies. I waved the PA's own budget in his face the other week on television, saying, you know, this is the budget that provides the pay for slay, which provides the money to terrorists and their families that goes up on an escalating scale depending on how many Jews you've killed. And depending on the number you've killed and how great your act of terrorism was, you'll get more money from the PA, which, of course, is funded by the British, European and American taxpayer, among others. And he just, of course, denied that was the case. Well, that's a lie. But I think that there are enough people, including, I hope, some Palestinians, who notice that money that is meant for them instead goes into the pockets of these corrupt groups like Hamas and the PA. I'm perfectly confident that truth wins out, because it's happened in history.
Douglas touched on before the global fascination with the Jewish people, which has, in essence, split the world. It's a Middle Eastern conflict, as you said many times before, and no one seems to care about any other massacre or genocide happening around the world unless there's Jews involved. Rabbi Hirsch, how would you explain such a phenomenon?
Well, I mean, if you're talking from a broader perspective, in other words, you're talking about anti-Semitism generally and historically, the way I would view it is that we have to bring in the spiritual element as well as the political, economic, and other concerns. And that makes it a constant. Meaning, if you go back in history, you will find that for 1,500 years, anti-Semitism was of a much more religious nature. And at a time where religion became less relevant, in Europe, for instance, it morphs into racial anti-Semitism, and from there into economic anti-Semitism, and now it's sort of anti-Israel. You find that, let's say, in the 1950s, the Jews are being accused in the United States, in some quarters, of being communist, and in the USSR, of being capitalist.
Yes.
It's ubiquitous. Now, that doesn't mean that we should accept victimhood and that we should somehow give up the fight, but we need to bring an element of that to the response. Clearly, there is a political fight to be fought, but that lies at the base of it, and I don't think there is a catch-all response that would otherwise be able to adequately explain across the board the anti-Semitism that has existed, the longest hatred, as it's often referred to.
So the longest hatred just takes different forms, and every time you cut off its head, it will no doubt regrow in another form.
Absolutely.
Yes, I completely agree. I mean, the latest one, as you referred to, is, of course, the point that Europeans and other Western peoples have given up on the idea of the state. Israel represents the state. It's now said that Israel is a colonizer. Where does that come from? But from people who have been brought up and gestated in this language of colonizer and colonized.
Douglas, we had a huge shock on the 7th of October. The whole Israel had a shock. You're an expert in the Middle East conflict. You've seen the front lines of many wars around the globe, and you've studied it, and you sort of understand the mentality, I would say, better than most. Did you predict this in any form? I don't necessarily mean the scale, but the shock factor, and did you predict it?
I've been warning about this for a very long time, for most of my adult life. I think that most people in the West, including until the 7th, a lot of Israelis, did not really understand the nature of what we're all up against, which is a segment of Islam which is a cult of death, and which, of course, has boasted to us for many decades that they love death more than we love life. And I've warned about this to my fellow Brits. I've warned about it to my fellow Europeans, fellow Westerners, Americans, and others. And we've had little tastes of the reality. We did at the Bataclan in Paris. We did at the Manchester Arena in 2017. We've had tastes of it, but Israel got the worst taste of it, the biggest on 7. America had a taste of it on 9/11, more than a taste, but didn't really understand from the public to the politicians really what they were facing. I have tried to persuade people that, and show people simply what we are dealing with. It doesn't require any interpretation on my part. We just need to listen to the words of groups like Islamic Jihad, Hamas, ISIS, and so on. They make their plan totally clear, but it is a plan so far beyond the comprehension of most people in a Western liberal democracy that the people think they can't mean it. I mean, we hear our politicians and others forever trying to rationalize it. Maybe it's socioeconomic, you know, maybe it's to do with unhappiness, or in the case of Gaza, maybe it's to do with the Israelis responding to Hamas aggression.
It's almost like we're a state of denial.
Of course we're in a state of denial. Of course, because there are several very hard to answer, if not unanswerable, questions that follow the moment you wake up. The first is, how on earth did we let this happen? And the second is, what are you going to do about it? And the second, in particular, is probably the hardest question you could put to any politician in a country like Britain. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do when a young man from Libya detonates and kills 22 young girls? Well, the current British thing is you sing Don't Look Back in Anger and you try to urge the general public to move on. I don't think that does anything. I think it's pathetic. It's not what I would do. But it's an example of the attempt to push away the reality. And maybe some people can push the reality away for a long time. I think America is probably in a position where it can continue to push away the reality. Maybe Canada, where I was the other day, I was in Vancouver, an anti-Israel demonstration. I thought, what do you know in Vancouver of this reality? But Israel can't ignore that reality because it's on its doorstep. And one of the things I've said after many months recently in Israel, tried to say outside the country is, you know, just have some sympathy for the fact that Israel is filled with people, many of whom dreamt the dreams that people in the rest of the West dream, but they can no longer afford to dream those dreams because the dreams were shattered.
Douglas, you mentioned the idea of pushing off the reality. In a way, there was a sense of complacency almost in Israel itself, which mirrors the 73 conflict.
Yes.
And they were caught unawares on a number of fronts. The idea that they constructed hundreds of kilometers of tunnels and no one noticed the earth being moved, the attack by South Africa in the ICJ, which was clearly well prepared and didn't just take place in the latter days of December. And that perhaps complicates the scenario because it's not just the rest of the world, but even within Israel. Now, in 73, it led eventually to peace, but you were dealing with a country rather than a group that, as you mentioned, prefers our death to their existence and to land and independence. So perhaps it needs a complete new level of strategic thinking, a high ground that hasn't been taken until now, in order to emerge from this sense of complacency and from the shockwaves that it created.
Yes, I mean, on the 7th of October, the glass shattered for Israel, for the Israeli people and the Israeli government. The whole conception, as they call it, was wrong. The conception that Hamas wanted to be corrupt and wasn't really interested in doing something like this. Everyone now realizes what they have done, what they would like to do, and what they'd like to do again and again and again. But yes, I mean, of course, everything in hindsight is clear. And of course, in the Commission of Inquiry, we'll find out, like in 73, exactly what did go wrong and who was responsible. Well, there are two observations I make. One is the lack of imagination about what one's enemies actually want to do is, as you know, is sort of driven by human optimism and desire. Let's hope that that's the case because, you know, I have a wedding to go to. I have plans. I've got a holiday booked. Nothing should disrupt my life. I hope my life will continue as normal. It seems to be built into us. But the second is, of course, that very interesting question of whether the Israel's technological advantages weren't actually a disadvantage. I mean, I think of the Iron Dome in Israel, for instance. Of course, Hamas has never developed an Iron Dome and never would, because it's not interested in stopping rockets hitting the people of Gaza. The more the merrier, as far as those bloodthirsty cultists are concerned. But it's a very interesting question. If Israel hadn't had the Iron Dome, maybe this all would have been addressed many years ago. Because actually, when one looks back at it, if you were in a place like Sderot and in the south, I've been many times in the past, why did people put up with children having to run to air raid bunkers every day? Well, it was because the rockets were always being fired from Gaza, which Israel had withdrawn from. But, you know, we had the technological advantage in Israel to shoot them down. But in hindsight, how did Israelis become used to the fact that this was normal? In other words, maybe that some of the technological advantages and skills that everyone had been reliant on, maybe they were a downside in a way. Maybe they kept reality off.
I lived in Jerusalem for about 7 years, and I remember speaking to a friend of mine, a non-Jewish friend of mine in England, and suddenly a siren went off. And I said, okay, I'm just going to have to call you back. I put down the phone, I called him back a few minutes later, and he said, well, what siren went off? I was like, oh, just for the missiles. And I realized in myself, and I was saying it so casually and coldly, he's like, what do you mean missiles? What, you live at a place like that? And it's just a fascinating part of humanity. We just get used to this. There's an extreme level of hate in Gaza, and the educational system. I mean, we saw now when the soldiers went in, the things they found kids' puzzles depicting Palestinians invading Israel. They showed kids' computers with the background of Hitler on, Adolf Hitler on them. Is it possible, and how would one deprogram such an intense level of hate looking towards the future, whatever the future will bring, but this point specifically?
Well, some people say that having watched the footage of the 7th, some people, journalists and others, have said, you know, these people are behaving like psychopaths. And I said, there's one important differentiation, which actually a psychologist I spoke with in Israel enlightened me to, which is, of course, the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath. The psychopath is probably born, a sociopath is made. Hamas has had control of Gaza for 18 years, which is precisely the time from a child's birth to the end of their formal education. In 18 years, you can make a sociopath. And in my view, Hamas has made a generation of sociopaths. How could you not? How could you not if you were educated into this absolutely apocalyptic end-time jihadist cult? So there'll be two things to solve. One is the de-radicalization of an entire population, and I'm not sure that's been tried before, certainly not for a very long time. And it certainly can't be done without winning. It can't be done without Hamas being visibly defeated and crushed. And the second is, who will do the educating from now on? Now, of course, the UN is meant to be responsible for much of this, but we know that the UN has proved not just incapable, but wicked in not just stopping hate, but actually encouraging and paying for hate to be taught in Palestinian schools. And again, not just in Gaza, but in the West Bank as well. I would listen to people like David Cameron and their plans for the Middle East when they can explain to me how either the PA or Hamas should be able to run one school or one hospital. I mean, I say, you know, since I think the two-state solution business is all nonsense now, it's all dead, obviously, certainly for the time being, for the foreseeable future. As people sometimes say, well, what is your plan? I'm saying this slightly sarcastic, but not entirely, which is give the Palestinians one thing to run. Give them one school to run and see if they can do it. See if that one school can avoid teaching to kill the Jews. See if that one school can actually teach maths and arithmetic and literature and reading and writing and not teach the students to kill the Jews. Maybe they should give them one hospital. See if they can just avoid the temptation to make it into a weapons dump. And then we'll see. But at the moment, they've proved incapable of this.
But that's a pretty bleak outlook for the future, given that there, firstly, are 5 million Arabs between the West Bank and the Gaza, and secondly, that the international community doesn't see it that way. So from a more, I don't know, to call it realistic or practical perspective, what do you see even in the short term, over the next 12 months, even if Hamas is crushed as a movement, what moves do you see happening next to implement a way forward.
I think what I've just said is the position you have to start from, which is the recognition that there's nothing that the Palestinians have been given which they haven't been able to muck up, which they haven't been able to turn to the disadvantage of the Palestinian people as well as the Israeli people.
But that's unlikely to happen given the UN backing for their position. And what do you feel can be done?
My view is that it's a pretty insoluble problem for the time being, because it's extremely hard to give lots of things to people who want to kill, and no other country would put up with it. My view is that the Palestinians have mucked it up for themselves. They shouldn't have voted for Hamas in Gaza, or they should have overthrown them. They shouldn't have put up with the corruption of the PA in the West Bank. They shouldn't have put up with all the things the PA has done. They shouldn't have put up with billions of dollars of taxpayer funds from the rest of the world going into the pockets of the bank account owners in Qatar. There's lots of people around the world who are displaced. There's lots of people around the world who live in poverty or unhappiness. The Kurdish people have never done anything like the Palestinian people have done. And the Kurds do not have their own state. And the world is not massively exercised about it, and it doesn't. I mean, I've traveled around in northern Iraq and elsewhere and seen the Kurdish people, and they're remarkable people, but there's no international calling for them to get special treatment or their own state or anything like it. So, you know, we accept that there are problems around the world which are not currently soluble and or solvable, and maybe this is one of them. When somebody knocks their head against the wall repeatedly and makes no progress, you would have thought that you could decide perhaps that this was not the wall to hit your head against.
It's very difficult to relate to sort of episodes in history when dealing with Jews or others, where ordinary citizens have become murderers and sadists. And as we heard last night with the hostages and this sort of depravity that they were describing, which was hard to imagine, and certainly things that the Western world hasn't heard since probably the Holocaust. How do you explain the mentality? I mean, you mentioned before they're being educated from a young age, but is this something that we've seen before, human beings reaching such a level?
Yes. I mean, it's happened throughout human history. It's the thing, as I said, that Westerners find it impossible to understand or very hard to understand until they see it, that the jungle is real and that the monsters are real. They exist. They'll probably always be with us. And a child may pull the duvet over its head, but an adult should not. You should face up to it.
We are seeing an unexpected rise in anti-Semitism on the campuses, as is well known. Do you understand this as simply being almost a fashionable political stance? Or is there something slightly more sinister there?
There's a lot that's more sinister. I would say that the people involved in that sort of thing fall into two groups, you know, the sinister and the stupid. The sinister are the people who, you know, they want Israel to lose, and they want all of Israel's enemies to win. Okay, that's their view. I want Israel to win, and I want Hamas to lose. If you want Hamas to win, there are people like that, and they're out there, and they're all over the place, and they don't really hide it very much or very well. Most of the organizers of the marches in London are affiliated with Hamas. I mean, it's a fact that very rarely gets out there, but almost all the groups that organize the marches are Hamas affiliated. So, okay, so that's the sinister groups. The silly ones, the stupid ones, are the ones who are just being carried along on what they see as a wave. They're the same people very often who, you know, just before October the 7th and all this were screaming about the climate emergency. These are people who are addicted to a sort of finding meaning in their lives by throwing themselves at big things that are far beyond their comprehension or understanding, and which they can do nothing about. But what they do is take out their frustrations with their own lives on other people, on this occasion against Jews. And it's also, by the way, with the campuses and others, what I've often referred to as the disappearance of the adults from the room. My view is that if you run a university or any other such institution, you should say, this is a place of learning. It's not a place of chanting. It's not a place of beating people down with slogans. This is a place for the dialectic. It's a place for dialogue. I don't want them to become fevered pits of international argument or arguments over international affairs. I believe that a university should be a place of learning. Something which most of the American universities, or many of them, have forgotten is their purpose. I would like to see the adults in the room remind them of that. There's just far too much pandering to the students on this. Somebody should say to them, I'm sorry to say this, but you are not here to do this. And it wouldn't matter what side you were on. I actually wouldn't like it if university life in America or Britain was mainly taken up with people chanting things about Israel in a good way. It's not the purpose of the university. The purpose of the university is learning. And this is all the opposite of that.
Norman Finkelstein. So he would claim that he's the ultimate advocate of peace, and that's why he's so vehemently anti-Israel. I think Jews have historically always been part of the liberal camp, back when, before liberalism became a sort of a cult, and probably the most aggressive form of a cult today. But I think Jews have historically been liberal simply because that was our way of being allowed to practice our religious beliefs without the consequences of the country we were living in. But now that liberalism has almost gone the other way and become a very aggressive group, it's always thinking, how do we sort of toe the line between trying to have freedom of religion, but at the same time trying to distance ourselves from what liberalism has turned into, people like Norm Finkelstein?
Oh, this is very easy. This is very easy, and prominent thinkers have laid this out very clearly. I wish people listened to them. John Gray, in his work Modus Vivendi, it's a very good essay anyone can read, explains the two types of liberalism. The first one is the one you refer to, which is political liberalism that allows, for instance, for freedom of conscience, freedom of belief, freedom of worship. That's the political liberalism I believe in. But there is a second form of liberalism, which is liberalism as an ever-evolving, ever-campaigning movement. Now, that one is the one that many people are in. I don't agree that Norman Finkelstein is in that movement. I think he's just a sort of psychopath. But I don't say that lightly. I think he's a very disturbed individual. And he's certainly not an advocate for peace. How could he be an advocate for peace when he wrote in praise of the October 7th massacres as they were going on? You don't get the right to celebrate massacres and then pretend you're a pacifist. No, no, no. And we shouldn't give him that credit. But that second group of liberals, that second form of liberalism, is one that people, in fact, in a way, particularly Jews, I think, need to think about. Because a lot of Jews, particularly in my observation, non-observant, non-believing Jews, what I think of as Palo Alto Judaism, have fallen into this idea that although they don't follow the faith, they don't observe the holidays, they might observe some of them, they don't really know the prayers, but they've developed Judaism into this form of campaigning political liberalism. What's the phrase? Tikkun Olam. This, you hear this everywhere on West Coast America. You know, this is, I'm not very observant Jews, but you know, Tikkun Olam is all about that. And these are people who just happily morphed what was their religion into a form of justification for sort of left-wing political activism. There's nothing wrong with left-wing political activism, but shouldn't take the place of religion. In my view, it's a very, very dangerous thing to put in the place of religion. But these people, among other things, there's one other one on that one, which is very important. The only way I see, and I've mentioned this a number of times before, the two places that anti-Semitism in our time comes from most prominently are from the Muslim world, including from Muslim communities in countries like Britain. And it's not me saying that, it's Muslims who also say that. As a close enemy of mine, Mehdi Hassan, said many years ago, the only time I think he's told the truth, he said in a piece, anti-Semitism is the dirty little secret of the Muslim community. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. It's at every dinner table. It's always there. So there are two main drivers of anti-Semitism at the moment in countries like this one. This is the Muslim community, and there is the radical left. However, I add one caveat to that, which is it's always possible, since, as we said, anti-Semitism can come from every direction, not just a lot, but every direction. If there's anything that would cause a resurgence in anti-Semitism on the political right, and I think you see the beginnings of it, it is the perception among a large number of non-Jews, a growing number of non-Jews in the West, that Jews are disproportionately in favor of open borders in every country other than Israel. And this is a very, very dangerous turn, because it actually is true that a disproportionate number of those second tier liberal Jews, the ones who believe in Judaism having actually become a sort of liberal campaign organization, are actually, you know, disproportionately, you know, on the side of everything to do with migration, open borders, etc., etc. You have the great bogeyman in George Soros to sort of represent that movement. I just say this as a warning because it's alarming to me the extent to which you can feel a bubbling of resentment about that. I don't think it's in any way accurate to say that mass migration in the West is the responsibility in America of Joe Biden and in Britain of Rishi Sunak now, a more different PM every year, obviously. But I do think this is important. And that perception comes from this campaigning form of liberalism, which a lot of people, Jewish and non-Jewish, are involved in. But it's a great danger, and I try to flag it up where I can.
I think, in fact, you can trace the history of the Jews' involvement with liberal causes directly to the 19th century, when they are moving both away from religion and geographically to places like North America. And there needs to be a replacement for the morality that was the center, the anchor of their life. And they now adopt liberal causes, initially causes which are very real, which you've, you know, alluded to, and then they adopt slogans, and that becomes worrying. And perhaps to bring that full circle to something that we were discussing earlier about anti-Semitism in general and where it exists today, it's interesting that I have, over the last 20 years, taken many trips to Eastern Europe, to Poland in particular, spoken there to victims, even to perpetrators. And it's interesting to note how, when it comes to anti-Semitism, there's almost a disconnect from the logic. Whereas, and in fact, I think Lawrence Rees points this out in one of his books, that in China or in the Soviet Union, people would say that they did what they did, which was morally wrong, out of fear or because of government control. But where it comes to the Jews in the Holocaust, it seemed to them to be the right thing to do. And that is something which I think Jews who are not part of the bigger picture are losing sight of. That anti-Semitism is a reality. And I think when you spoke about the shock that Israel underwent on the 7th of October, I think the Jewish world as a whole, with the reactions that took place in Harvard, within the BBC and other institutions, I think that woke up a lot of Jews to the concept of it and to how liberalism has to some degree become a slogan rather than a value worth fighting for.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, I mean, it doesn't need to be left right. I mean, some Jews have said to me in recent months, you know, well, you know, you're more conservative than I am, and I'm worried about that because, you know, I agree with you on this or the other. It doesn't matter. It's not a left right thing. It's perfectly possible to remain decent on issues like anti-Semitism and be a trade unionist. You know, it's not my particular political direction, but so what? There are certain things you can just agree on, basic fundamentals of decency. But the interesting thing, that the challenge that a lot of these people have at the moment, the people who are, as you say, have woken up somewhat after the shock of the 7th, one of the interesting things I do hear is a great woundedness from a certain number of mainly liberal Jews who say to me things like, you know, I was there for BLM. I was there for... I was speaking to a friend of mine who's Jewish who came through Israel the other week from America, and he was much involved in the civil rights movement in the 60s, as a lot of American Jews disproportionately were. And he's still like...
Why haven't the world paid us back?
Why isn't there any... The other obvious case is South Africa. You know, South African Jews were disproportionately at the forefront of, with their black friends and neighbors, brothers and sisters, they were disproportionately at the front line of fighting apartheid. Where is the reciprocity? That's the thing that I hear from liberal Jews so much. And I'm very sorry for them, because it's a steep learning curve when you realize that people you have expressed solidarity with will not express solidarity with you in return. And in many cases, you know, people tell me they haven't even got a call from their friend saying, you're okay, you know, how are you feeling?
Do you feel threatened at all? Do you almost feel a bit like potentially Salman Rushdie?
No, I never talk about that. I do what I do.
And you don't feel a need for security?
I can't. I never talk about that.
Well, final question. Mike Freer. He is the local Member of Parliament in Golders Green. And he has been in the news because he stepped down due to his being so pro-Israel and the threats he got to his life. People like you obviously are brave and courageous, and you, even though we hope that you're representing the silent minority, they are silent. Would you ever consider running for public office? Obviously, this is a question that's been on many people's minds, but...
I get asked it in Israel, by the way, so I'm not so stupid as to run in Israeli politics.
You need to be physically fit for that.
Oh, yeah, it's a contact form.
Yeah. But in England, whether it's Parliament, Prime Minister, anything...
The people ask me quite a lot. I've sort of been asked for many years now about that. I just want to be able to say things as I see them, and to try to correct untruths where I see them. As Auden said, all I have is a voice to unpack the folded lie. I have always felt that if I went into politics, whatever party I was in, I would, even if I got nominated for a seat and I won the seat, I would lose the whip on day two. I think that's pretty much a given. I would never want to silence myself. And I think one of the fastest ways, perhaps the only way to silence myself, would be to join a political party that would stop me talking. And I think it would be terrible for me. And some other people would be disappointed as well. If there was ever a way to do it without having to silence myself, then maybe. By the way, I just want to say, if I may, about Mike Freer, I take, and this isn't a criticism of him, I hope it's not taken as such, I actually am not one of those who take the standard view on him, and on, indeed on his colleagues. I think that when an MP says, I feel so threatened that I'm going to stand down, that is a moment when the whole state should be behind them. I mean, the infrastructure of the state as well as the country. I wrote a book many years ago on the conflict in Northern Ireland. We had MPs who've been killed before, not just in recent years, David Amis, Joe Cox. We had MPs who were killed in the Northern Ireland conflict, and many, many politicians whose lives were threatened so badly that, you know, on a daily basis, their cars had to be checked for bombs and so on. And we didn't give in. We didn't give in, and that was just to the IRA. I believe, and since Finchley is the seat in question, I think this comparison needs to be made. What would Margaret Thatcher have done in this situation? And the answer is, we know, because much worse did happen. Margaret Thatcher did not just face some threats. She was almost killed in Brighton. And she lost colleagues and dear friends in the Brighton bomb. And the next day she was out front and she said, we do not give in to the men of violence. The conference will continue. Now that's the Britain I know and love. And I want to see that Britain back.
Considering Suella Braverman getting sacked due to saying that the pro-Palestinian protests are too violent for her likings, I don't think it'd last a minute.
Suella Braverman turns out to have been correct too early, it seems. Since now, Rishi Sunak says that what she said is correct. He said the same thing last week on the steps of Downing Street. So it seems that the former Home Secretary's only crime was being correct but early. I regard being correct and early as being a virtue. I hate it when people are correct too late. It's not much use then.
Douglas, thank you so, so much for giving us your valuable time. You have a very packed schedule when you come here. In fact, you practically live in Israel at the moment. I don't know if you have an ID yet.
As a non-Jewish aliyah, the rabbis are working round the clock. Very complex problem, that.
We'll try and advance the process.
In the few hours you had here, we really appreciate it. Thank you.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. In order to watch that interview, please see the link in the description below. And make sure you give this 5 stars if you enjoy it. Please subscribe so you don't miss another episode and follow our journey unpacking thousands of years of Jewish history. Make sure you don't miss next week's episode either, where we interview a soldier who gives a very personal account of his experiences in Gaza. Thank you and good night.